The People's Historian, Howard Zinn.
In a real sense, Howard was born into class consciousness. And that's because he knew very early on that the standard American myth about all you have to do is work hard and pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and inevitably you can get anywhere you want to go. Howard knew that was a myth.
That's Martin Duberman. We'll talk with him about his biography, Howard Zinn, A Life on the Left. We'll also hear an excerpt from my 2005 interview with Zinn 5 years before his death. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Historian Howard Zinn's greatest claim to fame was his book, A People's History of the United States. A perennial bestseller, it brought a new perspective on American history to generations of readers, highlighting the importance of ordinary people in shaping events. But Zinn played a far greater role in making history than many realize. His first teaching job was at a black women's college in the South, just as the civil rights movement was heating up. Among his students were future leaders like Alice Walker and Marion Wright Edelman. And Marion Wright Edelman, with whom he worked in the civil rights movement. He was instrumental in that movement and then later in the anti-war struggle. As always, Howard Zinn was a passionate defender of social justice, whether he promoted it with his activism or his scholarship. But he was also a modest and deeply private man. That made it a challenge for my guest, Martin Duberman, whose biography, Howard Zinn, A Life on the Left, was published in fall of 2012. But the book manages to paint a compelling personal portrait of Zinn within the context of the very public events and movements that shaped his life. Duberman, like Zinn, is a historian and an activist. He's authored over 20 books, including a biography of Paul Robeson and the memoir, Cures, A Gay Man's Odyssey. Martin Duberman, welcome to Writer's Voice. Those who are familiar with some of your earlier biographies know that you like to delve into a person's private and public life, or private and political life. You weren't really able to do this so much with Howard Zinn, although I think actually you did glean just enough to kind of round him out. He guarded his personal life pretty closely.
He did. The way I've heard it anyway, Howard himself, toward the end of his life, spent a lot of time vetting his archives. His family opened all the archives to me, but when I started to read through, I was fairly shocked at the lack of personal material. I was able, as you said, to round it out or deal with that portion of his life somewhat by interviewing many of his close friends and also looking at the archives that some of them have deposited of their own papers, which include letters from Howard.
Well, I have to say, I think it really works because instead of maybe getting into very much about his personal life, although, you know, there is some of it, this is really kind of a portrait of Howard Zinn within his times, a portrait of the times as well. And as such, I felt that it was in some ways a biography that was richer in interest than many. You know, I'm often not that interested in somebody's personal life unless it has a whole lot to do with their public life. And often it really doesn't. And certainly in Howard Zinn's case, it didn't. So how do you feel, you know, after having kind of struggled with this issue, how did you feel about working out this solution?
I feel okay about it. I guess at heart I'm a gossip monger, and so I wanted more of the inner man, that is, you know, his feelings about family and friends and so forth. But it was okay. I mean, what I've come away with is the sense that Howard really didn't change much throughout his entire life. And his grown children have told me much the same thing. His daughter Myla said, my father was always the same. He was always in the same mood. I had asked her, well, how did he do so much flying, like flying to North Vietnam on a moment's notice? And she said, oh, but he could sleep anywhere. He could sleep on a plane. He could sleep on a church floor during a civil rights demonstration. What you saw was what you got, essentially, with Howard.
And he was a pretty approachable and equanimous guy, wasn't he?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Now, he felt that he'd been born with class consciousness. Tell us a little bit about Howard's childhood. Where was he born and into what kinds of circumstances? What were his parents like? What did they do?
He was born in Brooklyn. He was born into a very poor immigrant Jewish family. Neither parent had any education beyond around the fifth or the sixth grade. And there were three other boys along with Howard in the family. It seems to have been, despite the poverty, a quite happy childhood. And also, his parents were smart enough to realize that Howard was the one who was drawn to reading and to studies. And so they saved their pennies, and they really had very few pennies. And they bought him a book, and that was it. I think the first book was something, the first book was something about Reconstruction, but...
Yeah, which seems to me almost a portent of the future. You know, Reconstruction here, we're talking about the period, the post-slavery period in the South. Here's a book about history and about a period of history that brought into stark relief issues of class and race.
It may have been a spark. We just don't know. These things are so mysterious. And in fact, Howard didn't actively get involved in the black struggle until later when he was down teaching at a black women's college, Spelman, in the 50s.
Right. Well, he did get political. However, before that happened, there was a demonstration in Times Square in 1939. I have to say, as I was reading your description of what happened there, I thought, well, gee, some of the police tactics visited upon the Occupy movement were really not so bad in comparison to what happened even under FDR. So that demonstration turned Harold from a liberal into a radical. Tell us about what happened.
Yeah, it's a very difficult passage to trace, because there are blanks here or there in the evidence. We do know that in Brooklyn, as a teenager, he hung out with a group of friends who themselves were quite radical from the few hints we have. A couple of them were either in the Communist Party or they were too young for that and were hangers-on. But anyway, it was his friends who persuaded Howard to join that demonstration in Times Square. And, I've seen film footage from those years of the 1930s in which the police on horseback would charge into demonstrators, and hit them over the head with their billy clubs, often provoking severe injury. And Howard himself was hit and woke up many hours later in a doorway. The march or the demonstration was long since over, but it was certainly an episode he never forgot.
And what was it, I mean, other than getting hit over the head, that made him realize that there was some place further he had to go, that something fundamental was wrong in the country?
Well, I think, as you've already said, that in a real sense, Howard was born into class consciousness. And that's because he knew very early on that the standard American myth about all you have to do is work hard and pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, and inevitably you can get anywhere you want to go, that there are no obstacles or barriers based on race and gender, education levels, contacts, all that stuff. So Howard knew that, that was a myth. He knew that his very hardworking father, who was alternately a window washer and a waiter and had a lot of physical injury as a result of those jobs, that his father never got anywhere, that he ran in place throughout his entire life. So Howard knew that, you know, no, not true. Hard work is not all you need in order to get ahead.
Yet Howard's own story was one of coming up from poverty. How did he make the shift? Where did he go? What started him on the path towards becoming a historian?
Well, Howard was the only one of the four brothers who was interested in going to college. And he not only did that, but once he was in that environment of learning and the university and intellectuals and so forth, he knew that that was where he wanted to spend his life. I don't mean necessarily in academia in any formal sense, though he ended up being an academic, but he was never simply that. He was, from an early age, a political activist as well. But he then got a PhD from Columbia, and his PhD, which was on LaGuardia in Congress, that's in fact the title of the book, it was published, which is not often the case with doctoral dissertations.
And for those of our listeners who don't know who LaGuardia was outside of being an airport, tell us who LaGuardia was.
Lord. This is Fiorello LaGuardia, who was mayor of New York City and later a mayor, a member of Congress, and a champion of the poor.
And Howard was able to go to college because of the GI Bill.
Yes.
So, you know, he came up in a time of actual rising social mobility that seems less and less available to many people. I know that, you know, he was of my mother's generation who was able to go to Brooklyn College for free.
Right.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with biographer Martin Duberman about the people's historian, Howard Zinn. So then he went to Columbia University, he got his PhD, and it resulted in him getting an offer from, as you mentioned before, Spelman College. He got an offer that he took to go and teach at Spelman College. Could you describe for us what Spelman College was like in the 1950s when he went down there?
Howard arrived in 1956, and at that time it was essentially a finishing school trying to turn young black women into genteel young white women. The rules were very strict. The young women wore gloves, if you can believe it. They had to be up at a certain hour early every morning. They had to attend chapel regularly. No men were ever allowed to enter their rooms, though Morehouse College, which was for young black men, was almost directly across the street from Spelman. And, you know, for Howard, and he was by then married to Roz, and they had two small children, and for the whole family, it was a considerable culture shock to be placed in that environment. Of course, the civil rights movement was beginning. The Montgomery bus boycott had happened, and some of Howard's students were very much conscious of the struggle. and a couple had more or less quietly participated. But once Howard got the lay of the land, and that was pretty quick, because Howard was a quick study on everything, he and his students shared this sense that the city of Atlanta, and even more so the Deep South, was a real prison for black people, and that something had to be done. The way Howard describes his classroom experience is that, you know, as one of the very few white teachers at Spelman, his black students were initially very quiet and respectful. But Howard taught in a very informal, conversational way. He always encouraged dialogue. He was never the kind of professor, you know, who stood up in front of a room or on a platform and lectured. In other words, gave the truth to his dutiful students. Now, Howard really mixed it up. He liked controversy and discussion.
And he had some students who went on to some incredibly illustrious careers.
Yes.
There was Alice Walker, Marion Wright, who became Marion Wright Edelman, the founder of the Children's Defense Fund, and Hugh Plop Us Down, Martin Duberman. In your biography, Howard Zinn, A Life on the Left, you put us right down in the midst of that. One has the sense in reading this biography of the tremendous ferment in the South among the African-American students that Howard Zinn had, and how they themselves went through a transformation with him in this struggle.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It was a shared experience. Some of the students had taken a tentative first step. You know, Howard then encouraged that. He brought some of them, for example, to the Georgia State Legislature. And as soon as they entered the balcony, they were confronted with a sign, whites only. And they sat down in the white section. And there was an absolute uproar on the floor of the Georgia legislature. The legislators, some of them stood up on their chairs and, you know, screamed, "You niggers, get out of there. You know, there's a section over there for you people." And the police ushered them out and, you know, they talked it over together, and they decided, okay, we do want to see how this process works, so we're going to go back, and we will sit in the white section, but for the last time. And that's the kind of engagement that Howard was responsible for. You know, he went with the students. They shared experiences together, and those shared experiences deepened their decision to struggle against a very unjust society.
So they sat in the colored section for the last time, but then very soon after that, they became involved.
Yeah,
in
I meant the colored section.
Right.
I think I said the opposite. Yeah.
Yeah, and then they became involved in the sit downs that happened in Atlanta, and then you go on to talk about Freedom Summer. So what was Howard's involvement in the whole civil rights movement in the South? How did it go on from that first action in the legislature?
Well, Howard, I mean, this will give you some measure of how deep his involvement was. Howard, along with Ella Baker, were asked to be, at one point, the senior advisors to SNCC. That's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the more radical black organization which was conducting this series of sit-ins and sit-downs. So that's a measure, I think, of the respect with which Howard was held by the black movement itself. And I came across one historian when reading the background for all this, she didn't cite any evidence, but I'm forgetting her name and the name of the book since I read so many dozen, but I do remember it was a very good book. And what she said at one point was, Howard Zinn was such a modest man that to this day we have never fully acknowledged the extent of his involvement in the civil rights struggle.
So what were some of the key, I don't want to say that, you know, he wrote the policy on the civil rights movement, but he was involved in some of the big struggles, among them the whole issue of what was the proper role of white people in the civil rights struggle. Where did he come out on that?
Yes, he was involved, and that was somewhat later as the movement had evolved. Some of the younger black people in the movement felt that black people had been trained to defer to whites, and that as long as whites were involved in the civil rights struggle, certainly in the Deep South, that they would be assuming positions of leadership simply because blacks had elevated them into those positions, not feeling quite equal to the whites involved. No one can say to what extent and how many of the members of SNCC actually shared that attitude, but we do know that eventually SNCC did advise its white volunteers to go back to their own cities in the north or towns or wherever they were from and organize their own communities in support of the black struggle.
And in fact, many of them did do that. I remember that because I was part of that movement, although I was a little too young for the civil rights struggle. I came a little bit afterwards with the anti-war movement. But it was very much something that I think the lesson had been taken by a lot of the young radicals, that it was time. In fact, the anti-war movement itself was a way in which young white students could organize other students, as we did, to protest against the draft, to go to Canada, to resist.
Right, absolutely. Newark, in terms of the black struggle, Newark became one of the central points where whites tried to organize the white working class community there, which I know only because a student of mine was involved in it.
We're speaking with Martin Duberman about his fascinating biography of the great historian, the people's historian, Howard Zinn. A Life on the Left is the name of his book. Let's move a little bit to the anti-war movement. This was in 1967. Howard came out with possibly the first book, anti-war book, Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. He was one of the earliest critics of the war in Vietnam. Tell us a little bit about his work in the anti-war movement.
That book, which you mentioned, I think is among the strongest of his books. It was an exceedingly powerful argument for immediate withdrawal from the war. And that was in 1967 when the anti-war movement, you know, was in its infancy. Howard gave one of the very first public speeches against our involvement in the war. He did it on the Boston Common. If I'm remembering correctly, I think that was as early as 1965, and only a handful of people were there as an audience because the anti-war struggle had not yet caught on in massive numbers. When he spoke there just 3 or 4 years later, there were something like 50,000 people jammed on the Boston Common to hear him. And, you know, throughout the period of the war, Howard was deeply engaged. You know, I can only give you a few examples, and that will suffice for the whole. I mean, for example, he helped Dan Berrigan, the Catholic priest, who was outspoken against the war, and with his brother, Philip Berrigan, had invaded at night the files of various draft boards and poured blood over the files. Anyway, he helped to hide Dan Berrigan. He was significantly involved with Daniel Ellsberg.
How was he involved in Daniel Ellsberg's defense? Ellsberg being he of the Pentagon Papers.
Well, Ellsberg used the Zinn residence as a place where he stored some of the papers. I mean, it was a long process, the actual release of the Pentagon Papers. And Howard was very much involved as an advisor to Ellsberg, and also, you know, as somebody who helped conceal the material until the time came to release it.
He also got a call in 1968, January 1968, the day before the Tet Offensive. He got a call from Dave Dellinger, who was one of the Chicago 8 anti-war activists, who asked him to go to Vietnam. Why?
Because the North Vietnamese had offered to release three American pilots who had been shot down and were currently in jail. We can't get inside the motivation of why the North Vietnamese chose that moment or these men. But Howard, along with Dan Berrigan, immediately said yes when he got this call from Dave Dellinger. And the two of them flew over the very next day, as I recall it. And, you know, it was a long and grueling trip. They had trouble making flight connections once they got to Laos and so forth. At the end of it, when they actually had the three airmen in tow, both Berrigan and Howard were angry because the U.S. government insisted on flying the airmen home on a government plane, which had not been part of the deal, and which made it, you know, which took it out of the hands of private citizens intervening in response to an invitation from the North Vietnamese. But it was a major episode in Howard's life, yes.
And kind of emblematic, you know, here was, as you say, this private citizen, one of the people who played a role in an important diplomatic mission. Howard was also, I think he was most famous as the author of A People's History of the United States, which was published first in 1980. Could you talk a little bit about Howard's view of history, history from the bottom up?
There are several parts to this, I guess. Howard felt, first of all, that standard textbooks of the day were going back to 1980, which is when A People's History appeared, were altogether too much caught up with the lives of the privileged and the story of American triumphalism. And what they left out were the lives of, you know, so-called ordinary working-class people, you know, their efforts to improve their lot, their strikes, their struggles. And he also thought that most textbooks that existed were, in fact, highly prejudiced, and they gave a not only incomplete but an untrue picture of what America's role in the world had been, for example. And in A People's History, Howard details the extraordinary number of times that various U.S. administrations have intervened in the internal affairs of other countries. Far too often that was in order to bolster a dictatorship or an army general. And most textbooks left that out. The very year before Howard published his book, there had been a study of a good study of high school and college textbooks, and that study had concluded exactly what Howard himself thought, that the textbooks were deeply biased and did not give students an accurate picture of what the American past had been.
Martin Duberman talking about Howard Zinn. His biography is Howard Zinn, A Life on the Left. We'll talk more after the break.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Howard Zinn's biographer, Martin Duberman. Before the break, we were talking about Zinn's best-known work, A People's History of the United States. The book explored history from the bottom up, the role ordinary people play in creating history, especially when they join together to fight for social justice. Yet there were social movements that Zinn didn't cover at first or cover very much. Like anyone, he was a product of his time, Duberman says.
Howard, like every other historian, always brings to that fragmented evidence his or her personal values, past experiences, in other words, their subjectivity. So the writing of a work of history is always the intersection of an individual historian with emphasis on individual interacting with a limited amount of data. And that's why history keeps getting rewritten, because those individual historians keep changing. It's not only the amount of data that increases, though that happens too, but it's also that we see the pre-existing data in a different way. For example, until women historians arrived in the profession, which is, you know, a quite recent phenomenon, you know, except for a very few female scholars who go back to the early part of the 20th century, it was largely a white male middle-class clubhouse. And so once women historians enter the field and they read the record of past women's lives, they have some very different things to say about that body of evidence than the white male historians had ever said.
Well, Howard Zinn was a white male historian. Did the women's movement make an impact on how he saw history? Did the rise of women's herstory make an impact on him?
I would say overall, I would have to say no. But even though I consider myself a feminist and I am also a gay rights activist, and Howard didn't pay much attention to the gay rights movement either, but my argument in his defense is that, you know, we're all born into a particular generation, and the issues that are prominent in that generation will, for the next generation, say, shift. When Howard, you know, came into adulthood, the major issues in American life centered around race and class. There was no viable women's movement. There was no gay movement. Howard, unlike the vast majority of fellow historians, actively engaged with those two issues, the most prominent issues of his day. And I don't see how you can legitimately ask anything more of anybody than that they engage the issues of their day.
And yet one does think, I spoke to Howard Zinn maybe a couple of years before his death, and on the occasion of, there was a dramatic retellings, it was voices of a people's history of the United States.
Yeah.
And you know, the voices of women were represented in that book, so, and of women who were not just coming from a class perspective, but also very much from a perspective of, you know, of feminism. So,
but that was later. That, you know,
mm-hmm.
with each edition, if you trace the editions of a people's history, in the first edition, there is no mention of a gay rights movement, though it was already 10 years old, and there was the barest mention of a feminist movement. But with each edition of the book, a little more space is devoted to both those movements. And it isn't as if Howard had ever said anything negative about either movement. He never did. I mean, he never disapproved of the feminist movement. But, you know, he did become somewhat more educated about feminism and gay rights as he grew older and as those movements matured. But, you know, it's asking an awful lot of somebody in their 70s, for example, to start retooling their perspective on the world. That Howard spent his life engaged with public causes seems to me admirable enough. We don't have to get into the blame game of, yeah, but he didn't give as much time to women or to gay people.
Yeah, and I don't think that is what's at issue here. I mean, what you really show in your book, Martin Duberman, in your biography, Howard Zinn, you know, that he was a passionate fighter for justice.
Yeah.
And in that sense, as movements towards justice rose and became worthy of history, one could say, he did at least give a nod to them and perhaps more. Could you talk a little bit about of Howard Zinn as a historian and an activist, how these two roles, you know, meshed within him, and was there any tension or problem? You know, I can imagine some people saying, well, if you're an activist, you can't really be an objective historian. And I don't think Howard would have agreed with that.
No, nor do I agree with it. I've been politically active most of my adult life as well. And it seems to me that what most historians who would draw such a charge against Howard, say, are people who, in some semi-conscious way, want to excuse their own passivity. The historical profession, even now that women have entered it, is by and large a, you know, fairly conservative group of people. They don't involve themselves very much in public affairs. Or during the Cold War, I know at the time where I was teaching, there were a number of men in my department who were working covertly for the CIA. So, you know, some do get active, but on the wrong side, unfortunately.
Well, your book, Howard Zinn, is really a wonderful read, and I want to thank you so much, Martin Duberman, for talking with us here.
Well, thank you. I genuinely enjoyed it.
Martin Duberman is Professor Emeritus of History at the CUNY Graduate School, where he founded and directed the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies. You can read an excerpt from Howard Zinn, A Life on the Left, by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we hear an excerpt from my 2005 interview with Howard Zinn.
I'd sing more about more of this land, but all God's children ain't free. I'd open up every door I can, 'cause all God's children ain't free. I met a beaten, broken man. He shovels dirt, but got no land. And he held out his hand to me. All God's children ain't free.
5 years before his death in 2010, I spoke with Howard Zinn about his companion volume to A People's History of the United States, Voices of a People's History of the United States. It's a collection of writings from the great protagonists of social justice. In this excerpt from our conversation, Zinn talks about his perspective on history, war and peace, and the two sides of the American story, idealism and exploitation. War was a great preoccupation for Zinn. He saw it as an abomination. In this excerpt from our conversation, I asked him about the influence of his own personal experience as a soldier on his feelings about war. Did your experience in World War II have something to do with your own politics, with your own sense of history?
Well, I suppose it does, you know, in several ways. And of course, the most immediate way is that when I began to rethink my participation in the war and to rethink the war itself, because after all, I volunteered, I enlisted in the Air Force, I was an enthusiastic bombardier, and it was only afterward that I, maybe after learning about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and after learning about the bombing of civilians and the obliteration of Tokyo, in one night of bombing, 100,000 people die in Tokyo, that I began to rethink this whole issue of just wars and unjust wars and good wars and bad wars, and made me, I suppose, realize that if we don't tell the history of World War II in such a way that brings out the unspoken, that brings out the, you know, the horrible, unnecessary killing that went on in the war, and if we don't bring out the what happens domestically whenever war comes, you know, in this case in World War II, the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans, putting them in concentration camps, essentially. Well, we want to make people think about what war does, not just to other people, but what it does to our own society, how it corrupts us, how it makes us cold to the treatment of people inside our country who are suddenly considered enemies, as is happening now to Muslims who are being picked up, you know, under the guise of the war on terrorism, picked up and detained and kept without benefit of fair trials. And so, yeah, all of that, for me, I think personally, my experience affected my attitude towards history.
You included a speech that you gave at Johns Hopkins University in which you said that you start from the supposition that the world is topsy-turvy. What did you mean by that?
Well, I was writing at a time, and it's 1970, when people in the United States who were opposed to the war were committing acts of civil disobedience and were being sent to jail. And nonviolent acts of protest against the war, they were going to jail. And I was saying, isn't this the world crazy? Isn't it topsy-turvy that so Daniel Berrigan is going to be in prison for protesting against the war, and the president of the United States, who is responsible for the deaths of huge numbers of people, is sitting in the White House? And isn't it the world topsy-turvy when David Dellinger, who has devoted his life to peace, goes to prison, and J. Edgar Hoover is in power? I was saying the wrong people are in power, and the wrong people are out of power. And that's what I meant by the world being topsy-turvy. And I think that still is true, of course.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're hearing an excerpt from my 2005 interview with historian Howard Zinn. In reading your book, it seems to me that America suffers from a split personality, because seeing these two sides, I mean, one part of America's personality is a beacon of justice and equality. I mean, you know, the Declaration of Independence does still stand as a document in many ways that that has inspired constitutions throughout the world. But the other side is that of injustice and inequality. Mm. Which is the true America for you?
Well, I don't know if there is one true America. As you say, you know, there are two sides. But one is the ideal. One is the unrealized. That's the problem. And I suppose what dominates reality, unfortunately, so far, is not the vision, of the Declaration of Independence and, you know, those noble words of equality in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and, you know, what is called the American dream. Well, those are words, those are ideals, and unfortunately, most of the time, they have not been realized. And it's the other side, the reality of slavery, of racial segregation, the reality of today of 40, in this richest country in the world, of 40 million people without health insurance, the reality of a really marauding America going through the world with its troops and its planes and bombing and invading other countries. I mean, that is the reality. And unfortunately, of those two sides of America, that right now is dominant. But I like to think that the other side, that is the noble vision of democracy and peace, is represented not by what the government is doing here and abroad, but is represented by all those people in this country. And there are millions of people in this country, millions and millions of people in this country who stand for those principles that the United States is supposed to stand for. It's these ordinary people, the people who went to Washington the other day and the St. Patrick's floor and the GI resisted. It's these people who really represent the best of the United States and represent the ideals of that United States that, you know, you just spoke about.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question about history. I've always thought about what is true history. Some people say that history can't be objective, that it's just different versions, like Rashomon, that great Kurosawa film. Mm. What do you say to that?
And it's true that, you know, that you will get many, many different versions of the same events, because the past is so complicated, and there's an infinite number of facts about the past from which you, if you are a historian, you are forced to choose, but you can't give it all. You don't know it all. And so you choose from this welter of facts, you choose what you believe is important. And in that sense, there's no such thing as objective history. It's always subjective. It's always the choice of the narrator, of the historian, to decide what is important. But that doesn't mean that every version, therefore, is equally deserving of attention, because I think we should have moral values that guide us and can tell us, well, this version of war which emphasizes military heroism, and you can do that, you can pick out all those instances in war of military heroism, and yes, that's part of history, it's true. But if you only tell that, then all that you're doing is glorifying war and glorifying militarism and saying to young people, oh, if you want to be a heroic person, as all young people want to be heroic, this is what, go to war and fight and win battles and so on, or even die, but it'll be in a heroic cause. Well, to me, that version of history doesn't deserve to be commended, because I think another version of history is morally superior, morally more desirable, and that version is the version that tells about war in its horror and tells about war as something manipulated by powerful people for economic gain and for their own psychological advantage. And of those two versions of war, instead of saying, well, it's like, well, they're different points of view and they're all equally valid. No, they're not equally valid if you have a set of values, principles that you believe in. And if you believe in peace rather than war, then one version of war will be more desirable to present. So yes, there's no way of having objective history, and you must really make a decision about what in the past is most useful in, I think, advancing the cause of humanity towards peace and justice.
So you're saying that it's a moral compass that drives you in your journey to uncover what's happened.
Yes. I mean, you take the story of Columbus, which is the very first story in our people's history and the very first subject matter of our book, Voices of a People's History. You can say, well, Columbus was a great adventurer and great seaman and great navigator and a courageous man and religious man, and this is what he did, and this is how he sailed, and this is what he discovered, and it's all true. But it omits what Columbus did in enslaving and kidnapping and mutilating and really committing genocide. And if you have any moral sense of what is right and wrong, you must not omit that. But the history books have omitted that. And when I wrote my people's history, I decided, no, if I care about the issue of seeing other human beings as not being important, people who are Indians or people who are black, people who are Muslims, people who are Jews, they're not important. They can be killed for your own benefit, for your own profit. They can be enslaved. You can do whatever you want to them, and you can call it civilization. You can call it progress, maybe because you've moved into their lands and you've started to create your own kind of society. But that, to me, is a sort of violation of the most basic moral principles that any historian, any scholar, any human being should stand for.
I asked Howard Zinn what happens when good people do bad things. How does he confront the moral ambiguities that sometimes crop up in history?
You have to tell the truth. And there are these moral ambiguities and these difficult decisions that have to be made, and they're not always pure and clear, and you have to make choices and do the best you can. But in presenting history, and if a situation is complex and the moral issue is a complicated one, and you face ambiguous situations, I think you have to present that in its truth and leave it to the reader to make up his or her own mind about that situation.
Many of the documents in your book are a record that just causes the most heart-wrenching sadness in the reader. I think that's what I refer to as the emotional impact. Indentured servants, for example, I really didn't understand exactly, what kind of atrocities were practiced on them.
It's true. I mean, there's an example of the history that's not told, and of the simplified history that we get. Well, there were black slaves, but white people were free. But of course, huge numbers of white people were not free at all. They were brought here, as really enslaved. They were called servants. They presumably served only, 7 years of indenture of servitude, but they were treated like dirt and really treated like slaves. And that's an important thing to know about, because throughout history, while black people have been the most maltreated, and white people without resources, poor white people, have also been victims all through our history. But I want to say something about this point you make about how you can read these stories and it's sad, and you can become discouraged. But one of the things we wanted to do in this Voices book is, aside from recounting the miseries of people, making people aware about what white servants went through, what working people went through, what the Japanese went through in World War II, what Native Americans went through, what they endured, and all sad stories. But we also wanted in this book to bring out the stories of resistance mm-hmm. and the inspiring stories. Yes, the young girls of New England who went to work in the textile mills, you know, it's a terrible story of the conditions under which they worked, but it's heartening to see that they fought back, that they created their own newspaper, they created their, they got together, and then they went out on strike, and it's important to, I think, inspire people with those people who have always fought against war. And to read the speech of Eugene Debs, sure, he goes to jail, but the fact is, to read his words, the words that sent him to jail, speaking out against war, or to read, that's inspiring, or to see the resistance of black people in the 60s in the Civil Rights Movement, or to read the testimony of Fannie Lou Hamer testifying before the Democratic National Committee at the 1964 convention, to read Alice Walker's poem mm-hmm. about this defiant young man who, in Alabama, a black young man who decided that he would break all the rules and he would go swim on a white beach, nude. And, of course, the poems and the songs, Dylan and Bruce Springsteen. And so our hope is that that the material we have in this book is not simply disheartening because it tells of what people have suffered, but it also gives us the words of protesters. I mean, there's the letter that Adrienne Rich, the poet, wrote to Bill Clinton. Well, she actually wrote it to the National Endowment for the Arts, refusing the National Medal for the Arts because of the Clinton administration had just destroyed the rights of poor families to federal aid, and she refuses this. And talk about connection with the present. Didn't this just happen that a poet, just in the last week or so, refused an honor from the White House in protest against the Bush administration?
Well, this is just a terrific volume and a terrific resource. So thank you so much, Howard, and for putting this together, and Anthony Arnov as well, your collaborator.
Yes. Well, this has been good talking to you.
Howard Zinn in an excerpt from my 2005 interview with him. You can listen to the whole interview by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.